This is Paul Hurt and Jen Sweeney of Arizona State University interviewing Carl Walters at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, BC on August 18, 2018. Carl, thanks for being with us today for this interview.
You're most welcome.
Would you start by telling us your full name, the positions you held in the Adaptive Management Program, and the years that you were involved with it?
Okay, I'm Carl Walters, Carl John Walters, Professor Emeritus, University of British Columbia, where I've been since 1969. My involvement with GCDAMP began in 1996 when we had a proposal accepted to conduct a series of modeling workshops and policy analysis workshops for the program. Our main contact at that time was Ted Mellis in the Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center. I then worked primarily with people at GCMRC over the next decade or so, and I had an appointment from 1998, I think it was, till about 2010 as the Grand Canyon Senior Ecologist with a contract from GCMRC, so that would be a USGS contract.
And what kind of work were you primarily doing during those years?
In the first few years, we were doing primarily development of large simulation models using what's called the Adaptive Environmental Assessment and Management Process, which is basically identical to what in recent years has been called Structured Decision Making. USGS has done in the LTEMP process. So what we did was to go in and sit down with large groups of scientists, managers from the agencies involved in the canyon, and stakeholders. And we tried to build computer models of the Grand Canyon water and riparian ecosystem and to try various management policies, mainly associated with trying to maintain the ecology of the Grand Canyon, its fishes and vegetation and animals. The primary result of that early work was a recognition that their monitoring programs were largely, well, there were very large uncertainties about how that ecosystem was going to behave under management, and that their monitoring programs were largely inadequate to detect changes and more particularly to detect the efficacy of various management experiments that they were proposing, like high flow experiments to manage sand and things to try to save the endangered humpback chub and so on. So what I then did, recognizing this high uncertainty associated with their monitoring programs, was to shift most of my attention to the aquatic ecology program, mainly the fish program, and to work on field monitoring designs and the implementation of those designs in the canyon. So I did something like 15 of the monitoring trips down the river, these 18-day long trips where you catch fish and tag them and things like that, and develop various methods for analyzing the data that they were collecting to try to get better population estimates and so on. And then late in that period, in around 2008, we ran another series of workshops using an ecosystem modeling approach called EcoPath with EcoSim to try to get at food web structure in the aquatic ecosystem and how it was changing over time. But by about 2010, I think they were getting tired of me, and I was getting tired of traveling down there all the time, and I kind of dropped out. I ran one small workshop on aquatic ecology in 2014 with some of the GCMRC scientists. I had very limited involvement with the GCDAMP administrative structure. I could not make sense of that structure. When we first went down there, the the operation of the GC Damp from the from a science side was being managed by Barry Gold, who'd heard of our adaptive management approaches, and he was the one that got us a contract to go down there and work with them in the first place. And we were told about these administrative structures, the TWG and Technical Work Group and the AMWIG, but we never really saw them. I think I was invited in to a couple of TWG and AMWIG meetings and asked to give talks about what we were doing, but we were never directly involved with them except in one multi-attribute utility analysis exercise in the mid-2000s, trying to quantify trade-offs between different management objectives and performance measures for the adaptive management program.
So most of your work was with the Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center.
Then. Yeah, one of the things that when the adaptive management, this AEAM process first started back in the 70s, we had two large contracts, one with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and one with Canadian Department of Environment of the day. And we applied this workshop modeling technology to a whole series of case studies in Canada and the United States. So we looked at things like caribou management in Canada and hydroelectric developments in Canada and fisheries. And then in the States, we looked at a series mainly of water management problems around the Sacramento River Basin and so on. One of the really striking things that we saw in those applications was that we had a really difficult time with the American groups that we were working with. And the Canadian groups, when we would go in and sit down with them, scientists, managers, stakeholders, all they wanted to do was focus on the problem and the analysis of the problem and what we could do in the way of modeling. The Americans, on the other hand, wanted to focus basically on administrative process and bureaucratic process and how the things we were doing would basically further their bureaucratic careers. So we had an awful time getting them to even talk about the science issues and the modeling issues and so on. And they wanted to do this other thing of figuring out how they were going to manage all this administratively.
Was that?
And that's what we saw when we were invited to talk to Twig and AMWIG. The technical working group hardly had any technical people of any competence on it. There were more scientifically, intellectually competent people on AMWIG than on Twig. And when we sat in on their meetings, they were mostly about budget matters and funding allocations and things like that, rather than about matters of substance in the adaptive management program, the substantive uncertain discussion of the substantive uncertainties and the options for dealing with those. So we saw that same problem we'd seen in other case studies earlier, as soon as we hit the Grand Canyon.
Do you think that got in the way of achieving some of the goals of adaptive management? Or was it just an extra layer of bureaucracy that slowed things down a little bit?
I think that the latter. I think it mainly just slowed things down. The working groups that were actually developing, collecting data and developing policy options and so on like that were largely doing that outside of that administrative structure, like through our workshops and through other things. The management experiments that were tried over the period, high flow experiments and steady flow experiments and some trout removal experiments and so on, it was never entirely clear how the decisions to do those had been arrived at. It's interesting. They're probably from a scientist, from an ecologist's point of view, the single most informative experiment that's been done in the Grand Canyon wasn't these high-flow experiments to get all the publicity about sand. The most informative thing they ever did was to stabilize the river for 4 months at a low flow in the summer of 2000. And that generated all manner of striking ecological changes in the system that helped guided a lot of our later work.
Do you remember why?
I could never figure out why that experiment was conducted, because I don't recall at all the process that led to a decision to do it. In fact, the science group that I've been working with had kind of warned against doing it. We thought it might do more harm than good by triggering outbreaks of exotic species of creatures that have invaded the canyon. And in fact, it did do that with one of the species, the tamarisk, mm-hmm. salt cedar that lines the riverbanks. There are still tamarisks living in that system that recruited during that low flow event down at a low level near the riverbank that are horrifically flooded for much of the year nowadays with the water going up and down. And they're still there from 2000.
Very resilient species.
Yeah, horrid creature, that one. Yeah.
So you don't remember why they decided to stabilize the river at a low level for those four months?
I was never really told the story, exact story of how that decision was made. I just remember that we said, Bureau of Reclamation, presumably, came out with the decision to do this. And it was never clear to me what the consultation process had been that led to that decision.
It may have had something to do simply with hydropower generation and drought conditions in the watershed, and nothing to do at all with experimental management of the river.
Trying to save some water for Lake Powell.
Well, we'll look that up and find out. Sounds like a very interesting event, especially since, as you say, they learned there were a lot of changes that some were surprising, some were merely instructive. Can you think of any others besides a tamarisk recruitment that happened at that time?
One of the things we were seeing around the early 2000s was that the trout population, rainbow trout above Lee's Ferry, it's basically a valuable resource in its own right. It's an internationally known trout fishery, but it's also a threat to humpback chub because the trout disperse downstream and eat baby humpback chub. So there was this endangered species versus fisheries conflict that we were a bit worried about. The rainbow trout population had built up dramatically when flows were partially stabilized in the river starting in about 1991, they reduced the diurnal flow fluctuation that created better conditions for baby trout. The population had built up and then it was starting to crash. And then
from
it crashed
what?
Down to a relatively low level, and then it around 2010 or 2012 it built up to another peak and then it crashed again. And some of the ecosystem modeling work we did was to try and figure out why there was this violent population cycle in the trout, because it made a cyclic threat to the native species, native fish species. They are just now sorting out what the probable reason for that is, and it's something that we had looked at in the early modeling and then it kind of put aside as probably not that important, and that's the management of Lake Powell. So Lake Powell stores water for both producing power out of Glen Canyon Dam and from delivery of water to Lake Mead to equalize, to stabilize Lake Mead's delivery of water and so on. And if you're a hydro dam operator, the first thing you want to do is to get the water out of the dam as much as time as possible. You want to keep the level of the reservoir down as much as you can. They had had this horrific object lesson with the 1982-83 El Nino when they almost lost Glen Canyon Dam. They had plywood along the top of the dam to stop from having to use the spillway and the water levels. Huge flows through the system at that time. So a lot of their management actions were aimed basically, even though they weren't saying it, I think they were basically aimed at trying to keep the reservoir lower. But what's been found since then is that as the reservoir goes up and down, it does so on a multi-year cycle. It doesn't fill in 1 year. It takes years of wet conditions for it to fill and years of dry conditions for it to empty down. When it's near full, the water is drawn out of the bottom of the dam. Through almost all the water goes out through the turbines. And that water is very cold, and in any lake or reservoir, there's a gradient in nutrients. The nutrients get depleted at the surface and they accumulate in the deep water. So the water running out of the dam when the reservoir is high is very nutrient rich and it stimulates really high productivity in the Lee's Ferry region on down through the river, aquatic productivity. It's So that's great for everything from the fish to the peregrine falcons that eat the ducks, that eat the algae, and so on like that. So the whole food web responds pretty dramatically to these high productivity conditions. But when the reservoir is down, it starts sucking surface water, warmer surface water through the turbines. And that surface water is nutrient depleted, and the productivity of the river below goes way down. And that is expressed in everything from trout population collapses to skinny humpback chub to fewer ducks swimming around the river to fewer peregrine falcons. And it's the whole food web responds to that productivity driver. If we had understood that in the early days, we were told by a couple of the people who were working in the Grand Canyon Monitoring Research Center who were working on Lake Powell, we were told about this issue. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, this is outside of the scope of the work we're going to do. We're going to stick to working with what goes on below Glen Canyon Dam. So we made what's called a problem bounding mistake by not including the dynamics of Lake Powell and the way it was forcing the ecosystem in our analyses. And so we didn't look at any options for managing it differently. Mm-hmm. And in hindsight, it looks like a lot of the most interesting options for Grand Canyon ecosystem restoration have to do with how Lake Powell is managed rather than what's done in the river below.
Unfortunately, it seems like some of those options are foreclosed now. With 17 years of drought, the lake is down below 50% full, and nobody really expects it to be full again unless we get some miraculous rains or winter storms.
Sooner or later, there's going to be another big whack in El Nino. You know, it just took 1 year to fill the thing from a low to a really high level in 82, 83. So.
Well, a lot of people are hoping for that.
Yeah, that would be nice. But yeah, no, I think the climate change analyses and predictions are generally for more prolonged and severe droughts, just like we're seeing out here. So when you look out the window here, yeah, that's smoke. You've been told that we don't have a blue sky because of the forest fire situation because of the persistent dry conditions over several years that we've had here.
I just took a trip through the Southwest. A bunch of national parks and the Rocky Mountains with family, and we had smoke everywhere we went, and most of it was from California. California's been on fire for a couple of months, and all that smoke is drifting eastward.
My little sister lives near the edge of one of those fires, so we get lots of news about that from her.
Yeah. Carl, let me step back a little bit. One of the reasons that you were recruited to be involved in adaptive management programs because of your prominent position as one of the architects of adaptive management theory. And I wonder if you could just, you're probably in a better position than anybody else that we've interviewed, to talk a little bit about what adaptive management is, how it got sort of launched, how it has developed over time, and how that theory and your way of thinking, how that theory was attempted to be applied to this unique situation on the Grand Canyon and Glen Canyon.
Okay, so I think even as early as 1970, I think I had given a paper at an American Fisheries Society national meeting where I said, look, the models that we're trying to develop are not reliable for prediction because there's too many uncertainties that we can't resolve without large-scale manipulations and experiments. We're getting really good data on a lot of ecology processes, but not on how they fit together, and there's lots of ways you can make mistakes. So I had back then advocated experimental approaches to management, saying we need to treat management actions as experiments, recognizing that the outcomes of those experiments are highly uncertain. Then Ray Hilborn, one of my ex-students, and I were doing a sabbatical leave in the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Vienna in 1974 and 75. And we were working on fisheries problems, and we showed some of the data that we were working on to a control system theorist named John Casty, and asked him what we thought we might be able to use optimal control ideas to figure out how to manage fisheries in the face of variability. And John took one look at this and he said, "You have an adaptive control problem." And Hilborn and I looked at each other, and we were working for Buzz Holling, and Buzz Holling was known for his history of getting great buzzwords to describe the things that he was interested in, like resilience and so on. So here was this word, adaptive management. Hilborn and I looked at each adaptive control, and we said, "We've got a new buzzword." So that was actually the kind of formal launch of the use of the term adaptive control and adaptive management in ecological contexts. We published a big paper about it, won a major award and so on. But this was all going on in parallel with these workshop processes and so on. And Holling was seeing better, I think more clearly than Ray and I did, who were buried in the details, that the workshop processes were doing a really good job at exposing major uncertainties and at triggering discussion about the need for experimental management approaches. So he started calling those workshops the adaptive environmental assessment and management process, because the result they were producing over and over and over again was us saying to the collected people that were working with us, "We can't resolve these uncertainties by modeling. You're going to have to go out there and do an experiment. You're going to have to test things. You're going to commit yourself sooner or later." So the whole original concept of adaptive management was one of management as experimentation, basically. The explicit recognition of extreme uncertainty about the efficacy of a lot of the things that we do in management, the need to monitor those things and to actively make management changes to probe for better policies, and we call it probing for opportunity. But as that AEAM process got applied more broadly, a couple of people started to look in on the process as outsiders. There was a fellow named Steve Light, who was with, I think at that time, he'd been at the University of Minnesota, and he had he'd been working in on the Florida Everglades. And then there was another one who was working in the Grand Canyon system called Steve Gloss. Have you run into that name? Gloss was the administrator of the science side of the GC DAMP after Barry Gold left in the around 2000.
Gloss's last name is G-L-O-S-S?
Yeah, Steve Gloss. So Gloss and Light didn't, as far as I can tell, did not understand this idea that the basic product of an adaptive management planning exercise is an experimental design. They saw the process itself, the business of bringing together scientists and managers and stakeholders and working together and problem clarification, so on, this kind of dramatic enhancement of cooperation, really, that's required among stakeholders and scientists and managers when they try to build a model. They saw that model building process as being the core of adaptive management, whether or not it resulted in any recommendation to do experiments or anything like that. They saw it was essentially an administrative idea. You get people work together better if they're forced to be really clear about what they're dealing with their objectives, with their performance measures, and how they're going to make predictions about how to link performance to action. So they started this thing, a thing called the Adaptive Management Practitioners Network, and it started pushing the idea of adaptive management as collaborative work. People just working together in a more structured way to come up with better decisions without regard to uncertainty. And the word uncertainty doesn't really appear much at all in adaptive management definitions developed by that adaptive management practitioners group. Later on, when some of the adaptive management programs started to receive scrutiny in legal challenges, the lawyers started looking at this and started asking, "What the hell do you mean by adaptive management?" And they came up with this wonderful term for the thing that Gloss and Light had promoted, and the stuff is still being promoted strongly. They called it adaptive management light. Yeah. And to my mind, it over the years in all sorts of settings has done more harm than good. It's led people into lulled people into a sense of confidence that they have solved problems just because they sat down together and worked together to build models. Rather than being forced to admit that they really didn't know what the hell they were doing out there and needed to manage it very carefully and differently.
One's about natural resources and ecosystems. The other is about the human dimensions of collaboration.
Yeah, exactly. And well, this whole administrative notion of how to administer better rather than how to actually meet objectives.
Do you feel like adaptive management should be the two of those integrated? Or?
Oh, they definitely, and they have been, and the process as we ran it definitely did try to integrate it, mainly because we always saw the basic product of the process to be the explicit recognition of high uncertainty and the explicit need to manage experimentally in order to resolve uncertainty about policy efficacy.
And be flexible enough about your goals to adapt once you monitor results and you see, then you adapt, right?
And to recognize that anytime you go out there and do an experiment, in nature, there's almost certainty to be serendipity. There's almost certainty to be surprises. Things you hadn't expected at all that turn out to be things you can turn into opportunities for improving management that you never even thought of.
Right.
That
probing for opportunities was a wonderful phrase. I love that.
Yeah. We wrote a paper. Ted Mellis ended up writing it and publishing it. Called Surprise and Opportunity in the Grand Canyon Adaptive Management Program, which no attention's been paid to that paper at all, as far as I can tell.
You said that was Mellis?
M-E-L-I-S.
M-E-L-I-S. And
Ted Mellis is one of the really key people in the development and persistence of the whole adaptive management program there. He's a scientist with GCMRC. He was the leader of their sediment research group for some time, and then later their ecosystem research group at GCMRC. And he was one of the lead people that maintained contact between the scientific community and Twig and Amwick. Mm. So a lot of what they heard came straight out from Ted. He was also a great administrative defender of his people. Uh-huh. And that in the early days meant defending the sediment research work, the high flow experiment work and so on, and making sure that the sediment research was always very prominent in any presentation to Twig and Amway. And that persists to this day. You can see this in the LTEMP process, where if you go through and look at all the records of the LTEMP meetings and the discussions in the LTEMP meetings, we say the SED heads dominated the meetings.
Sediment
and
heads.
And sediment related policies dominated discussions. Same thing happened to us, except we weren't fooled. We started out early on developing sediment budgets and so on and saying, hey, look, there's some really serious uncertainties going on with the sand management in this system that you people aren't admitting. And they still haven't admitted those, and the failure to admit them is reflected strongly in the character of the LTEMP results. Mm-hmm. So LTEMP basically said there's no need for experimentation with regard to high flow release experiments to build sandbars. We know they work, so we'll always include them in our plans, so there's no value of information for doing things differently. Mm. Well, that is seriously false. There's a huge uncertainty associated with the efficacy of those high flow treatments, which they've never been willing to admit. And that is, they can build little beaches in the upper end of the Grand Canyon by having these little high flow experiments, and they take pictures of them, these little beaches that they created up in Marble Canyon and so on, and they talk about how great this is. They don't talk about two downsides. That one of them is that most of those little beaches go away really quick, and most of them look like little pyramids of sand that erode away on really short timescales and aren't even usable as camping beaches. So they're not even fulfilling that objective in Marble Canyon. And then there's the whole rest of the Grand Canyon downstream, for which is still sediment starved, and these high flow events may actually be eroding the sand resources of the bulk of the Grand Canyon faster than if they didn't do them. So we'd be losing resources in sand sediment and riparian resources in the lower part of the Grand Canyon faster because of these experiments. So for the Grand Canyon as a whole, the high flow things may actually be a net negative thing.
When we interviewed Kerry Christensen, who represents the Hualapai tribe, he talked about how the high flow events bring so much sediment down that settles in their area of the canyon, Diamond Creek and downstream, and it causes tremendous problems for them.
Yeah, as soon as you get past Diamond, there's a little black canyon area for a few miles, and then the river just spreads out and is about a mile wide and about that deep. And yeah, that's where all that stuff ends up.
Yeah.
And on down even into Lake Mead. Yeah, it turns that lower canyon into an absolute navigational nightmare for people with boats and so on.
Yeah.
And because there basically isn't enough sediment going into the system anymore, it's trapped in Lake Powell, there's no way that they can restore and maintain the whole canyon. So they've been misleadingly, I think, focusing on their ability to improve things a little bit in that upper end by messing with the sand that comes in from the Paria and the little Colorado River.
Yeah, it's a difficult challenge to try to, they're now trying to see if they can't model sediment deposition coming out of the Paria to help figure out exactly when it is effective to do a high flow event and when it isn't. And that's really the only source they have.
So basically, the sandhead approach to research is to make it, and this is the way a lot of scientists operate, and it's antithetical to adaptive management, is to go more and more detail on smaller and smaller problems and narrow yourself down and keep your scientific sanity, keep your focus. So their focus is in their research and so on almost entirely on the upper end of the canyon where they can monitor and can do things.
And that's where the humpback chub are too, right? So
it's sort of in the lower part of that.
Part of the upper part.
yeah.
So let's talk.
And when you look at monitoring way down low in the system where some of these problems develop, even above Diamond Creek, the data are really limited. And there's still very high uncertainty. In fact, the best data we have about what's going on in the riparian ecosystem down the lower part of the canyon actually comes from camping beach studies that Shiplinski have done. Scientists that have gone down and just mapped the camping areas along the river. Have you been down the canyon?
I've been down the first half from Lee's Ferry down to Phantom Ranch.
And hiked out at Phantom.
And hiked out at Phantom, hoping to do the lower half this coming year.
Yeah, it changes quite a bit. You get a lot more of these big eddy, recirculating eddy systems and big sandbars with great big campsites and things like that that are really important for the recreational community. They're mostly down below Phantom.
Yeah, I didn't see a lot of that in the upper section.
No, the upper doesn't have these big, huge eddy structures. It's got a few of them, but not very many big eddy structures.
So let's talk a little bit about the significant changes and or significant events that occurred during, you were involved from about 1997 till at least 2010. Can you think of any particular events or changes in the evolution of adaptive management or the research to support it that occurred during those years?
Well, the modeling exercise and so on, as I said, led initially to this really strong warning that the monitoring programs were inadequate. So there was a major change in monitoring programs, and that extended to the sediment management program as well as the ecology side of the thing. So they got into some very detailed channel sediment storage monitoring in the upper part of the system. And in the ecology side, we set up a bunch of better monitoring protocols for systematically sampling down the river a whole variety of aquatic organisms and so on. And they initiated some repeated photogrammetric mapping exercises to look at vegetation change patterns over time in a systematic way that they hadn't been doing before.
And those were funded and implemented, that science got done?
Yeah, yeah. There was one program that was dropped, I think basically because the people who were involved in it just could not be convinced to behave sensibly as scientists. There was a kind of a terrestrial ecology research team that would go down the canyon and set mouse traps and count birds and things like this, and their protocols were pretty pathetic, and that research program was dropped as far as I know. You couldn't even, the way they were doing the work, you couldn't even get basic trend assessments from the data that they were collecting. They were so crude. So there was a major improvement in monitoring programs over the 2000 to 2010 period. There were really important experiments, most importantly the summer steady flow that was one of my favorite examples of an opportunity where, when you go way back into the early days of development of the adaptive management program, there were a couple of people that pointed out that if you stabilize the flow, it would change the thermal structure of the river. And it would create little warming conditions along the edge of the river that might be favorable to native fish. And we kind of laughed at that. You got this huge river running down there like that, and it's cold water and it's icy cold. And, you know what the hell can what's going to go on the edge of the river? It's just going to get mixed up with that cold water. Nothing can. Well, in the late summer of 2000, I was down there on a trip, and I was standing in the river with one leg in 10 degree water and the other leg in 18 degree water with a thermocline in between. Mm-hmm. So there was this dramatic development of shoreline warming along the river. Wherever there was the water slowed down, it would warm up.
You figure that out on river trips when you're trying to cool off or bathe.
Yeah.
You figure out there's warm parts and cold parts.
You betcha, yeah. And it's a little backwaters in the other place that's warm enough to have a bath.
So right.
You get down about mile 200. Yeah, anyway, so this was an opportunity, right, to maybe manage native aquatic organisms that need warmer water better. And it also was a threat in the sense that it triggered explosions of some non-native fishes that they didn't want.
Such as?
Oh, there's a fathead minnow. I really like those conditions. It's an exotic species. And then it greatly improves survival rates of little native suckers and fishes like that. Didn't seem to do much to humpback chub. And anyway, at the end of the experiment, they ran a big flushing flow to get rid of the exotics, and it also got rid of the native.
Erased the board.
Yeah, it erased the native as well. Yeah.
Wow.
So the main beneficiaries of it in the end, because they do cope better with those kind of pulses of water, with rainbow trout. They had a pretty good year. It was crazy. I remember walking down to the ramp at Lee's Ferry and headed down on a trip. And I walked up to the water and I said, "This is a fish hatchery. This is a bloody fish hatchery. I grew up around fish hatcheries, trout hatcheries, right?"
And
so the whole river smelled like a fish hatchery. I looked in the water and all along the edge of the river, the stable flow river, every 10 inches was a little rainbow trout fry. And so the whole edge of the river looked like a rearing trough for trout.
Wow.
They benefited dramatically from the stabilization of the water levels during that summer.
Were there any other events like that were unusual that you can
remember? Well, the HFE in 2008 was one that made it clear that these sandbars that the guys were generating with the HFEs didn't really improve conditions for camping and so on in the upper part of the canyon. They were little tiny bars and they were big and steep. And most of them were not usable and eroded away rapidly. Also, I'm trying to think what else. Then the other really major event, while I was still at all involved with the system, was the decision to proceed with the LTEMP process. And this kind of, what I would call basically a rediscovery of the wheel, where they repeated an awful lot of the kind of workshops and meetings and so on that we'd done back in the late 90s. With many of the same players, many of the same characters, and reach much of the same general conclusion about what's uncertain and what's not, except the sediment business that they persisted in treating as not uncertain.
What do you think? What kinds of research and monitoring and adaptive management do you think could and should have been done that maybe didn't get the kind of attention and support that it needed?
Well, the biggest single thing is the one that I think people have just started really getting clear about in the last two or three years, and after LTEMP basically as well, is this management of water levels in Lake Powell, where they do have certain flexibility to keep the water levels higher or lower, not just trying to minimize them all the time. From an ecology point of view, one of the biggest issues in the canyon has always been water temperature. Mm-hmm. The assumption has always been that native aquatic organisms would do better in warmer conditions than the dam results in. Fish, native fish and so on like that. And there was always this idea of an expensive temperature control device to bring warm water down through the penstocks. They had put such a device on Flaming Gorge above the upper end of the system, and it seemed to have generated some beneficial results downstream in the Colorado River. So there'd always been this kind of pressure to manage temperatures that way. And our recommendation from the early adaptive management workshops was that, yeah, that is important, and you need to do something. So let's see if we can figure out how to build a cheap temperature control device using plastic film or something that will get warm water down to the penstocks, not in a permanent and expensive way, but in a simple, cheap way, and we can test it for a couple of years and see if that warming, what that warming actually does. And if it doesn't work, we can throw it away. And so the idea of building the TCD was passed to a research group in the Bureau of Reclamation, the engineering group, to figure out a design, and they came up with a $500 million concrete monstrosity as being the best design option. Well, of course, nobody is going to make a $500 million investment on a highly uncertain possibility of making an improvement for a few fish, right? Or maybe making it easier to have a bath in the river. So the TCD, temperature control device idea, never got any serious consideration in the LTEMP process. It was just said, look, this is too extreme. One of the LTEP mistakes was to try to measure utility to stakeholders for different circumstances on kind of arbitrary additive scales over different performance measures. They didn't actually do what we had tried to do, which was to say, well, we're going to try to compare different resources and different values from the system. We need to get them on a comparable scale. And that scale really needs to recognize cost and benefit. So we basically recommended a kind of traditional cost-benefit analysis to get at whether certain actions ought to be taken. You need to consider how much it costs as well as the benefits. And just because you can't quantify the benefits very well, they're not monetary benefits, doesn't mean you shouldn't scale them relative to the costs in some way. Well, with a newer way that LTEMP did it, this so-called swing weighting utility assessment method, or multi-attribute utility analysis method, they only look at the benefit part of that. Bureaucrats like that. They don't like anybody looking at costs. They want to look at benefit scales. They only want to look at the positive side of what they're doing, and not the public commitment, which is cost side. So they did screen out policies like the TCD from even being looked at. Then when the LTEMP was being developed, we ran into Rich Valdez, who was one of the scientists who was involved for many years in fish, way before me, in the fish ecology side of the Grand Canyon and its management. We stumbled on this thing called a Weir's impeller. which the Australians had invented for trying to manage water temperatures and oxygen in reservoirs in Australia. What it is this, it's a column about 10 meters in diameter of plastic that goes down 10 or 20 meters in the water. And it's got a big propeller at the top, and they spin this propeller and they drive warm water down through this big, big plastic tube, and then it goes down and breaks up the thermocline and can carry water all the way down the penstock. So we said, hey, look, we can get these weird impellers for a couple of million each. Let's put in 10 of these things and just blast warm water down to the penstocks, and we'll warm the river in a cheap way. And the L-temp process by that time had been come so carved in stone, looking at a very, very narrow range of policy options, that they really refused to even consider that broader option. One of the things we'd learned early on in adaptive management is you put a bunch of bureaucrats, managers and administrators in a room and look for options to try, and they will always tell you to keep doing whatever the hell it was you were doing before. And they don't want to change. It's the standard operating procedure notion of bureaucratic behavior that you don't take risks, right? And the least risky thing is what you've got away with so far, so you just keep doing whatever you've been doing. And that's basically the way L-temp options came out, is there's a very narrow range of alternatives that they're even willing to look at in water flow management and other things.
Hmm. Is that one of the things that frustrated you so that you decided to sort of step back around 2010, is the lack of options?
Lack of willingness to really take more risk with ideas for policy change.
And you think that would be, so the adaptive management work group is pretty broad based. There are a lot of representatives on there, from federal agencies to state representatives to resource stakeholders like fisheries people and river runners. And
they're all the kind of people that should have been involved in, and many of them were actually as individuals involved in the original adaptive management workshop process.
And the tribes, of course, are all involved. So where is this sort of conservative bureaucratic culture really coming from in your mind, and why do you think that segment of the adaptive management team has so much influence over decision making?
I can't claim to understand the administrative structure that well of what's actually implemented on the ground. I know there are two lead agencies that tend to be very conservative in their policy choices and recommendations. One of them, of course, is the National Park Service, mm-hmm. who claims ultimate authority over everything in the canyon. And then the other is reclamation. Mm-hmm. And reclamation is a big, powerful bureaucracy, and it basically, whenever anybody wants to mess with the water, they always can fall back on the Colorado River Compact and the series of legal decisions made about how the water has to move through the Grand Canyon.
Right.
It's moved down through the Colorado River system. And those compacts put really severe constraints on how much they can mess with the water.
Yeah.
Right. So
and the hydropower
and with
interests.
The storage patterns in the reservoirs and so on like that.
Yeah.
So basically the excuse for inaction, we call it an adaptive management in quotes, excuse for inaction for Bureau of Reclamation was always the Colorado River Compact. Mm-hmm. That they only could explore alternatives within a very narrow range defined legally through the legal decisions about water in the Grand Canyon or in Colorado River in general.
Mm-hmm. Were there any significant documents or reports that you would like to highlight that should be, remembered as important parts of the evolution of this program?
Yeah, well, the two papers that we've published in Ecology and Society is the name of the journal today. So, what was it called? It had a different name back in, they changed names at some point. Anyway, Ecology and Society is the way you would find it in Google Scholar today. The first one was Josh Corman and I's paper about describing the original model of development work and why and the decisions we'd made and what we'd included and who was involved and so on and so on. Then the second one would be Ted Malice's Surprise and Opportunity paper in that same journal. It's looking back from a perspective of about 2014, 2012 on what had happened and surprised ways we'd been surprised by the experiments.
Great. Well,
think of any others. Then another key one that I think is an example, I consider an example how not to do it, not to do things because of the stupid utility analyses and so on. Not the modeling. The modeling was good in it as well, but it's Runge et al. Open file report just came out, I think, released in 2018, one of the USGS open file reports on the LTEMP modeling process.
Spell the author's name.
Runge, R-U-N-G-E, Mike Runge.
Uh-huh. And that's a GCMRC open file report?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Title?
Oh, I
not sure.
Don't remember the title.
Date?
It was called, had structured decision making in the title.
Okay.
And I think LTEMP is also, LTEMP is also in the title.
All right.
Not
we can
sure
find it.
I ever downloaded that thing. I can take a look at my computer later and see if I can get that.
All right, yeah. And if you have handy PDFs of your article or Mellis' article.
The problem with Ecology and Society is they don't
let you download.
Give you PDFs. They want they're it's open access, but all you can get is the HTML, which is a real mess to deal with. I'll see if I can get those references for you.
All right, great. You've mentioned a number of individuals that you thought were particularly important to the evolution of the program. Is there anybody else that you don't think you've
met? Well, key startup for it all is his wife just died. You asked me to, you were meeting with him and he asked you to be remembered to me.
Oh yeah, Dave Garrett.
Dave Garrett, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Dave Garrett with was really the initiator of the whole thing.
Mm.
I think it was Dave that initiated the organization, the administrative organization for it, certainly the scientific review system that's been used over the years. I think it was probably Dave that brought in Barry Gold.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect also Steve Gloss into the system.
Those are two people we have not interviewed yet. So
Light and Gloss?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How about Barry Gold?
I haven't interviewed him, but I've got him written down as a possible.
Barry would be really good. Barry, it's just a real shame that Barry left the program. He was a kindred spirit and really understood what we were trying to do very well. And was, I think, also frustrated by the way the administrative structure that looked right, that looks like policy people and then science people, and you'd have these working groups, and he was frustrated that it hadn't performed as expected.
Uh-huh.
It's really weird. The people on the TWIG generally are less scientifically competent, in my experience, than AMWIG people.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really weird reversals of roles going on in that thing that I don't think anybody intended to have happen.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that that has been a consistent feature.
No, it's changed for a bit. So
yeah.
One of the things we noticed is that the TWIG behavior, I saw a little more of it than AMWIG, really depended on who was chairing it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were chairmen who just wanted to get through the process and survive the day, and others that wanted to become more engaged in substantive technical discussions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you to reflect a little bit more on that, because some of the interviews that we've had have been with people who were invested in the human dimension side of collaboration, who think that a significant part of adaptive management is getting key stakeholders to the table, getting them to talk to each other, getting them to respect each other's differing positions, and working on a consensus decision about how to move forward in a complex and uncertain environment.
Adaptive management light.
To what extent do you think some of yours and others' disappointments with progress in the program are based on the fact that some of what happens is democracy in action, which is messy and slow? To what extent is it just bureaucratic conservatism, as you've characterized it, and I'm sure there's a lot of that, and to what extent is it a commitment to democratic processes that are also sort of slow and messy?
There's any of that democratic process business in it. In the workshops that we ran, and what I could see listening in on parts of the LTEMP workshop processes, it was pretty clear that there was lots of this collaboration, and there was lots of consensus about at least the options to be tried. There was not consensus about the values, and there was not consensus about how to deal with some of the basic trade-off issues. So you want more power production out of that system, it's going to be at the expense of quality for rafting use and for fish and so on, because it's going to run the water up and down a lot more. Mm-hmm. So that's an irreconcilable trade-off. Mm-hmm. You can't produce more power without screwing other things up. And you can't settle that, I don't think, with a democratic type process. But maybe you're right, because what a more or less democratic process is going to end up producing in those situations where there are strongly conflicting objectives, it's going to produce a lowest common denominator. It's going to produce a compromise that isn't very good. And that's one of the things that did come out of our work, and it came out of the LTEMP work as well, that the current, what's called MLFF, modified low fluctuating flows, where they allow some fluctuation diurnally for power production, but they don't optimize for it. Mm-hmm. And it's enough fluctuation to degrade some ecological values and to make the river harder to use. That compromise may actually not be the best thing to do. Mm-hmm. That it is a kind of democratic, we can all live with this compromise, even though it's, lots of times the compromise is the worst choice.
Yeah, this happens in politics, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Yeah. You poor guys. Yeah. My number two son is thinking about giving up his job at Penn State. He's just about fed up.
Yeah.
He's frightened now. Mm-hmm. To come home. Yeah.
We talked a little bit about surprises, and I'm really glad that you mentioned this article by Mellis about surprises and opportunities, because that's something that Larry Stevens emphasized to us. He was our very first interview, and he's the person who probably more than anybody else is responsible for making sure this administrative history was supported, funded, and implemented. And he said that he thought it'd be interesting if we asked everybody that we interviewed, what surprised you? What happened that you weren't expecting? And I think surprises are a really interesting topic.
Let me say a little bit about Larry Stevens.
Sure.
We would never have been successful, anywhere near as successful as I think we were in the original adaptive management modeling, if it hadn't been for Larry. In every major case study that I've been involved in these large-scale management programs, with 30 or 40 case studies all around the world, there's always been a Larry Stevens. There's always been somebody who had a real system sense of what was going on, who was able to step back from things, to look at them from the standpoint of both the ecosystem ecology, broadly in the ecology, and also at the people. Mm. And in the Grand Canyon National Area, when I was appointed a Grand Canyon Senior Ecologist, when they wanted to give me that name, I said, "You're crazy, this needs to be Larry. Larry's the real Grand Canyon Senior Ecologist, not me." I'll never forget, I took my family to show them my work. I hiked in at Phantom to do the lower part of the canyon, the opposite of what you did. Took them on a trip down there, and to me, one of the real highlights of the trip is I arranged to time this so that we'd meet. They'd get to meet Larry.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We met him on the bridge coming across from Phantom across the river. My wife got to see this great ecologist, and I still think he's one of the greatest ecologists around. He is a really remarkable man.
I think that is his title at the Museum of Northern Arizona, a senior ecologist. So
yeah, he sure is. He's the Grand Canyon senior ecologist. Yeah, I don't know what happened with Larry. He was at GCMRC, and then he basically got driven out of the adaptive management program. I think he was just too outspoken.
Oh no, he's still involved.
Through Amwig.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's Amwig.
Yeah, he's on Twig and Amwig.
Twig and Amwig.
He goes to all the meetings.
Okay.
And
yeah, I wonder. He stopped participating in these kind of science workshop model development things that we were doing. Mm-hmm. And I thought he had been sort of...
Was that through GCMRC?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe that's it, is that he's not involved in GCMRC as much.
He was kind of persona non grata at GCMRC, I think, was in those days, probably still is. Huh. And probably because he's very critical. He's very honest, very critical.
He has high standards.
Very high standards, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
So you did your best interview with the very first one you did.
Yeah.
If you run into Larry again, say Carl thinks it's the world.
I definitely will tell him.
Yeah.
How about big picture, what do you think is the value of the program? And should it be continued?
Well, I think the basic value is it has uncovered a whole bunch of serious issues in the management of the ecology of the Grand Canyon, the management of riparian vegetation, of native species of organisms, and trade-offs associated with recreational use versus power production versus native fish sustainability and so on. There will continue to be experiments, whether or not there's a formal administrative structure. People working in the system, in Park Service and so on, are going to continue to work on ways, particularly to deal with exotic organisms, to deal with tamarisk, to deal with rainbow trout treated as a dangerous creature, and a bunch of other aquatic species that are fairly serious threats to the native biota of the Grand Canyon. And they're going to continue to look at experimental treatments of various kinds. Like one of the things we think may be the most effective for keeping trout from taking over the canyon is varying the flows a lot. We're going back to a hydro-peaking flow management system with violent diurnal flows during the time, the early part of the year when the trout are spawning, uh-huh. Just clobber their spawning.
I think they're doing that now. We talked to somebody.
Yeah, so then that's a plus for hydropower production. It produces more power at a time when it's actually pretty well still needed. And maybe good for native fishes. So there's going to be experimental treatments like that. Mm-hmm. They're going to eventually get around to doing a TCD of some kind, maybe using these weirs impellers. There's so much interest in making the system warmer and looking more natural that that's going to happen. Mm. I think there's despite LTEMP, all of our work, and despite LTEMP, there's still going to be strong pressure from environmental groups, and it may come through the Park Service because of the pressure of environmental groups on the Park Service to try to establish what they call more natural hydrograph for the Grand Canyon. Mm. There's this thing called the natural flow paradigm that an awful lot of applied aquatic ecologists subscribe to that says the best aquatic ecosystem is the one that occurs under the natural flow regime, however fluctuating it might be. And so their idea of ecological management is to restore that natural hydrograph pattern of flows going up and down seasonally. And they continue to press for what in LTEMP would be called, or our work would be called SASF, seasonally adjusted steady flows. Take out all the diurnal fluctuation and manage with a big peak in the spring of flow and dropping way down during the summer like the original system did. The sediment modeling uniformly says that that would be catastrophic. It would be hugely negative for sediment, huge sediment exports during the periods, but without the source to renew those from above, the natural hydrograph washed everything out of the canyon. What was there at the start of the year, but it also had a huge amount come in to redeposit. They got new to, so it would be deleterious for riparian resources, and it would generate enormous abundances of trout. It'd be very, very bad from the standpoint of exotic fish species to go back to that paradigm. So all the modeling says don't do it. But I'll bet you anything that they, that sooner or later they bow to pressure and they do it. They do it, and they'll do that in the canyon. So I guess what I'm getting at is that there's enough interest within the agencies that have specific resource interests and so on that they will pursue through whatever administrative structures are available to them, whether it's GC DAMP or what else, they will pursue adaptive management approaches. They will pursue experimental approaches. They may not call them that. They may say the natural flow paradigm is always the right thing to do and we should implement it because it's the right thing to do, rather than let's try it and see if it works. But it will. The experiments will continue to happen.
Yeah, that natural flow paradigm doesn't work because Glen Canyon Dam is there. Yeah. I'm wondering if the drought continues and there's no hydropower generation at the dam because the water level's too low, if that'll create a surprise and an opportunity that nobody is currently expecting.
Well, you know, then one of the things we tried to do when we were doing the original modeling was to try to reconstruct what the Grand Canyon ecosystem looked like pre-dam. There are some data from back then and so on. And basically what happened was every year the water levels went from 1,000, or flows went from 1,000 or 2,000 CFS in winter up to 150 or more thousand CFS during the summer. And it just scoured everything. So there was no riparian ecosystem at all in the canyon. It was scoured completely below a line that you can now see all along the river where the mesquite are. So there was mesquite up there, which is not really a great thing for all kinds of riparian ecology, and then scours and sand deposits in the wherever the water slowed down. So it was sand and scour right down the bottom of the river.
Not a lot of biological productivity.
No, and the species that survived in the system basically were tributary spawners, the humpback chub and flannel mouth and blue head suckers and so on like that. Those creatures were surviving in the tribs. Mm-hmm. They were spawning in the tributaries mainly, and then the juveniles were dispersing down into the river during this really interesting time that only Larry Stevens seems to have asked people to think about, of course. Is the late fall and winter when the river went down very, very low, and it probably was a very productive environment during the winter. The water cleared up a lot. There were lots of these big sandbars. There were lots of pools of water, slow-moving pools of water and eddies and things. The Indians originally came down there, grew corn down there in the maize down there in the winter. That's why they had the granaries, because they were down there. You didn't see any granaries when you went through Marble Canyon, did you?
There were archaeological sites. We stopped at one big one on a big alluvial fan coming down to the river, but I don't remember whether there were granaries or not.
Yeah, and I don't think the granaries are really down lower where there were these big sandbars and mud bars that were just great for growing maize down in the wintertime down there. And the granaries you tend to see above those areas. Yeah, and then of course you would have seen the Ark site, the salt, the Hopi salt.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we did go past the salt mine. Yeah. I almost forgot to ask you, you're a fisheries biologist, and one of the interview topics that has been controversial is the whole issue of what they call predation control, or killing rainbow and brown trout to try to enhance the survivability of
mechanical removal.
That's it. So we've had a lot of people mention that, and some saying it had to be done, others saying it didn't have to be done. What's your view on that whole?
Well, the early modeling work that we did, and some of the early field data that Rich Valdez and others and us had collected in the system, said that of the juvenile chubs and suckers that move down out of the tributaries in late summer and so on, there's a high predation mortality rate due to the trout. They're eating a lot of those little baby fish. And they're probably preventing the main stem of the river from being a more major contributor to recruitment into the spawning populations in the tribs. And they may also be preventing reestablishment of some of the humpback chub populations in the main stem further downstream. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we always thought that trout are a fairly major threat to native fish species, especially brown trout. Even though they aren't very numerous, they're much better predators than rainbow trout. So we had looked at options along the way, and they've implemented, I think, all of those in one way or another, like trying to kill off all the brown trout in Bright Angel Creek. And then the mechanical removal experiment that was part of the program. Unfortunately, the mechanical removal experiment that they did at the LCR and just above it,
Lower Colorado River.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what they did is, as an experiment, is where the confluence of the Little Colorado, most of the humpback chub juveniles and so on, they move downstream, but some of them do move upstream. So they took a stretch, I don't know, it was 10 kilometers above and 10 kilometers down to Hans Rapid, I guess. Not Hans. Oh, I've gotten the name of the rapid now. But they took a stretch of river, mm-hmm. and they basically just nuked it with electrofishing, and they knocked the trout population down dramatically. But one problem was that it seems to be kind of a thing about adaptive management experiments. When you do them one-off like that, something comes along to confound the results.
Yeah.
Within weeks of starting the removal, the water warmed up because the Powell had reached unprecedented sort of low levels, and there was warm water coming to the river. So it was chub babies everywhere. Uh-huh. After they removed the trout, well, was it due to the warm water, or was it due to the trout removal? One of the biggest adaptive management experiments on Earth has been on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, where we set up this complicated experimental design to look for the effects of fishing on the Great Barrier Reef's fishes. And just really typical thing, about a year the experimental design was implemented and put in place, with all these closed areas and open areas and reefs that were treated in different ways from standpoint of fisheries management. They get one of the worst hurricanes in history, go sweeping through there and just
devastated.
Creams these reef ecosystems all through. It's like, if you're going to do an experiment, nature's not going to let you get away with it for free without replication and so on. So the mechanical removal experiment or treatment wasn't repeated for political reasons, basically, and so we don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know whether it would work or not. I think it surprised all of us to get such a negative reaction from the native people. Yeah, that whole respect for life thing and so on just broadsided us. Mm-hmm. We had native people involved, the stakeholder involvement in the early workshops and so on like that, and they would sit at the back of the room. They never said much, and they never looked happy. And I think that that whole world, that whole structure that we work in is just so alien to their culture that they couldn't see one. And I think one of the ways they reacted to that was, well, we'll screw these bastards. You know, we have authority too, so we'll find some way to stop them from doing whatever it is they want to do. So call it respect for life or whatever. We see the same thing with First Nations people here in Canada. They'll block initiatives, not for any objective reason, but just because they're white man initiatives. Probably ought to be blocked for that reason alone. I don't blame them. You know, I would do the same thing.
Using it as leverage to try to get a better seat at the table, more respect for...
More respect.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier in the interview a difference, and I was fascinated by this observation, a difference between Canada and the U.S. in how these large collaborative efforts work out. And you said that there were a diversity of interests, the fisheries people, the management agencies, you know, commercial and sport fisheries. I assume First Nations were also at those tables.
No, they weren't actually.
No.
No. Not ever.
That's
the only
odd.
First Nations involvement I've ever had in a serious involvement in an AAM workshop was lap reindeer herders in Sweden. And they were such wonderful little characters that they ended up taking over the workshop from this bunch of Swedish puppy suit-wearing Swedish scientists and bureaucrats, and their three little lap reindeer herders with little hats, and we ended up doing all the modeling with the reindeer herders. They had a better systems sense of what was going on and were much more interested in the modeling and how they could help them improve their lives than were any of the scientists. So, yeah.
Well, aren't the First Nations...
That's a different kind of...
That is a little... Very different.
There's not been this history of getting screwed. The Laps have never been seriously screwed. They've always been a respected part of the northern culture in Europe. It's a respected... Yeah. They're neat people. Yeah, it's not... There's no history, no bad history there for them to feel they were...
Haven't First Nations been involved in fisheries management in the Fraser River watershed for many decades?
Oh, more, yeah. Well, the commercial fishery was originally operated largely by First Nations people.
Uh-huh.
They continue to do substantial portions of the monitoring programs for abundance of salmon in the rivers.
Uh-huh.
They have an allocation share, and they have very strong advocacy in management allocation decisions as to who gets the fish that are going to be allowed to be caught. They have influenced policies to shift fisheries from out in the ocean into the rivers where their traditional fisheries were, to take more of the salmon catch where the stocks are more separated from each other rather than where they're all mixed together out in the ocean. So they've certainly been much more engaged in fisheries over the years.
So with that deep involvement of First Nations in fisheries issues, why do you think they haven't been involved in these adaptive management workshops that you mentioned?
Because they were, back in the 70s, they were not brought into any of the formal decision-making processes. They weren't involved in any of the decision-making councils. They were seriously disrespected by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, the main management agency on the Pacific Coast here. We still had residential schools. Have you been down to see the... You haven't seen it. I'm going to have to take you for a little walk when we get out of here. We just erected a totem pole. 10,000 people helped stand up this totem pole down the mall, end of the mall here. That's a tribute to the children who died in our residential school system for many years. We shipped kids off to everywhere we could.
Take them away from their families and put them in these boarding schools.
And there's a little wooden schoolhouse partway up the totem pole. and it kind of glistens when you look at it. The glistening is from copper nails. There's 70,000 copper nails in that little schoolhouse, one for each kid that died in our residential programs. Wow. And those were going on until the early 80s. There were still residential schools active for over a decade after I came here, so the business of First Nations involvement in decision-making in Canada has just exploded through the 90s and 2000s. Mm-hmm. Their rights are now, well, our constitution, those are constitutions only about 20 years old. It explicitly recognizes their rights and so on.
Are they more involved now in current efforts at creating these adaptive management groups in the Pacific
Northwest? No, we don't. There's another paper you ought to look at. It's called Challenges in the Adaptive Management of Riparian Ecosystems. It's also in Ecology and Society, and it'll be under my name. People call it the Challenges paper. And it points out that of all the case studies that we started during the 70s and 80s, about 37 out of 40 were failures, went nowhere, were never implemented. And that included essentially, except for the Great Barrier Reef, it included all the fisheries case studies. So the last place where you'll see adaptive management in natural resource management is where it started, in fisheries.
That's very ironic.
Oh yeah.
Is that because with fisheries, especially oceanic fisheries or, you know, anadromous fisheries, there's so much uncertainty, there's so little control?
Well, no, the policy problem is you got an awful lot of people who say, trust me, I'm a highly trained professional, who they've convinced managers now to believe their models, even though the models are largely bogus. There is huge huge uncertainty, but the modeling staffs of the major management agencies have basically convinced managers that they know what they're doing. They don't need these kind of experiments and so on. There's a major experiment under discussion out here right now for the Georgia Strait area. We've had this huge decline in coho Chinook salmon survivals to the point where killer whales are starving and things like that. And there's lots of hypotheses about what's caused this, but the one that fits the data best and so on is the explosion in seal populations and sea lions that occurred after the Marine Mammal Protection came in the early 70s. We had our marine mammal populations went from a couple of thousand seals out in the Georgia Strait here to 45,000 of them. And they're eating themselves out of house and home. So
they don't have any predators?
No, there's the transient killer whales eat them, but the transients have just started coming into the Strait in the last decade or so, and they are knocking them down a little bit, but not enough. Mm-hmm. It's not a big enough population of prey to really interest the tree killer whales. Anyway, the problem isn't solving itself that way. So there's proposals to experimentally reduce the seal population by reestablishing Aboriginal harvests. Mm-hmm. The Indians kept their numbers down at much lower levels because they were both a valued food, and they were also used to make ulican oil bags, which was the most, ulican oil was the basic currency of a lot of the First Nations people for trading. Uh-huh. Up to interior First Tribes and people in the interior of British Columbia and even out in Alberta, they traded the oil from this little fish called an ulican. Mm-hmm. And they put it in bags made by seal skins, tying off the end. And they made their slaves carry it over the mountains. And this is a whole neat history of ulican oil and seals.
I read a little bit about that. Yeah. I think it was in Matt Evenden's book, Fish Versus Power, he might have mentioned this.
Could be, yeah.
One of your colleagues here at UBC, who I admire greatly, because we're both environmental historians, he's a great guy.
Yeah. Fish Versus Power. Mm-hmm. My world was always water and power. I grew up in a place called the Owens Valley.
You did?
Yeah, you ever heard of that?
Oh, Owens Valley, California, of course.
Yeah, my grandpa used to carry dynamite in his saddlebags to blow up the aqueduct. I tried to blow it up when I was a kid. So my family were cattle ranchers in the valley. And we're totally screwed by the city of Los Angeles.
Yeah, that was one of the great heists in American Western history.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so I
shouldn't have said that on tape.
This whole water and ecology culture business is deeply rooted in my from the time I was 5 years old. I was hearing about that sort of thing and seeing it, seeing the death of the valley, the death of the Owens Valley was still going on when I was a kid.
Yeah. Were you interested in when Chinatown first came out?
Yeah. Oh yeah, we all had to see that.
That's a great film. I don't know how well it represented the politics of water in Los Angeles and Owens Valley, but it was.
The writings classic. About that have been pretty ambiguous as to whether it was accurate or not. As far as I can see, everybody who's written about those politics has told a very different story about who was important at what times. Mm-hmm. And the only common thread was that Mulholland was a powerful personality. And was a main driver, and that's what I learned.
Yeah.
My parents and grandparents always talked about Mulholland as the great evil genius behind everything.
Mark Reisner in Cadillac Desert told a really dramatic tale of that.
I think he does it a little better than Water and Power, actually. Mm-hmm. The other big book. But I think to some extent in the Grand Canyon, coming back to another conversation we had a minute ago, if there's someone who is close to being like a Mulholland in the ecology side of the Grand Canyon, a huge influence and persistence and working hard and having great respect and hanging in there and continuing to go to meetings and all sorts of things, and knowing who to talk to when, it would be Larry Stevens. You know, I suspect if you go back and ask Larry about it again, that he was the one that was behind the 2000 steady flow experiment that taught us so much.
I'll ask him about that.
Yeah, do it. Do you actually see him fairly regularly?
Since I'm in Phoenix and he's in Flagstaff, see him as often. Yeah. But we're in contact quite a bit.
Okay.
By email. And of course, whenever I go to the AMWIG meetings, which is once or twice a year, he's always there.
Right. Okay.
And he also he's on an ad hoc advisory committee. There's three or four people from AMWIG who are on an ad hoc advisory committee for this administrative history project. Mm-hmm. And early on in the project, when we were trying to figure out who we should interview. Trying to get contact information for people to do these oral histories with, he was very instrumental. And
I'm really looking forward to seeing what you come up with, because you know, I, as a scientist and so on, I was outside of that administrative system pretty much all the time. I'd go down and do my workshops, I'd do my river rafting trips, I'd meet briefly with various people, I'd occasionally get called in to make a short presentation to TWIG or AMWIG. But that whole administrative system and the people involved in it and the bureaucrat and the agencies, the other agencies, NPS and Fish and Wildlife Service, I never knew any of those people. Mm-hmm. And I never understood what was going on, and it always made me really nervous. Yeah, I think that was also some of the attitude involved in creating the administrative structure for the program, was that warning some people like me from bad experiences in the 70s and 80s that these programs, everybody get excited about them and then nothing would ever happen. There was no leadership that would carry them forward and make something happen. Doing all the hard scut work, convincing all the different people that need to be convinced along the way to actually do something. That's a horrifically difficult thing to get people to actually do. So I think that's why that administrative structure was created in the Grand Canyon, is to give that, give it a permanence and a persistence for things to, give it long enough for things to actually happen.
Right.
And to that extent, you know, the Grand Canyon is probably the most, it is easily the most successful adaptive management program on Earth. In fact, it's the only one I would say is really successful at. Adaptive management takes a long time. It takes a long time to learn about things out there, especially ecology. Things happen a lot, happens pretty slowly. You need that continuity. You need that administrative structure. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what you guys discover about how it actually worked and who the people were that were critical in making some of the key decisions to proceed. Mm-hmm. And which individuals influenced those decisions a lot. I'm sure Rich Valdez was another key person. Rich was kind of their head fish researcher for some period of time in the system.
He was a fisheries scientist.
He did a lot of the early work and organized a lot of the early work on humpback chub monitoring. And has continued ever since then to act as an advisor to TWIG and AMWIG and GCMRC. And was an active participant in all the workshops and so on. When the LTEMP thing developed, he, like me and Josh Corman, we weren't involved in that. We ended up being drawn back in a little bit by state representatives from TWIG and AMWIG, who wanted to organize their own set of policy options and approaches to analysis, and we did some work together then with them, with those state people.
Was that, which states would have been most active in that? Was that Colorado by any chance? Because they're always mentioned as
Colorado, I think Arizona was certainly on Nevada. Uh-huh. Well, I think mainly those three. I'd have to look up the old reports we did and see who the names were on there. Yeah, those would maybe be the main ones.
So as one of the architects of adaptive management, and you've set up a whole bunch of adaptive management working groups, you've evaluated a whole bunch of them, your overall assessment is this Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program is one of the most successful of...
Yeah, despite all the things we can complain about it has... It has stood the test of time. It has made major improvements in monitoring programs over the years. There has been a reasonable admission of uncertainty about the efficacy of management, except on the sediment side, where the scientific arrogance persists in the same way it does in fisheries. And its experiments have been done, and we've learned from them. Not everything, but some good ones. I think we've missed some big chances for big experiments like the temporary warming ideas with temporary temperature control device or impellers. We've had, because mainly of the first native objections, we've lost one of our strongest aquatic management tools, the mechanical removal option. Forced to look for other tools, and that's good. I just hope that the foolishness of LTEMP saying you don't need to do experiments doesn't kill it. And the bottom line output of LTEMP was there's very little what's called EVPI, expected value of information from knowing things better. And that's not because there isn't high expected value of information in that system, it's because they did the calculations wrong. They just screwed them up. They did not admit enough uncertainty about some key policy options related particularly to sediment management. And they used stupid scales for measuring cost and benefit associated with experiments failing or not failing.
What do you think the consequences of that are?
Well, I was seeing some of this the last time I heard people talking at LTEMP. They were saying, oh, we don't need to do experiments. We know what we're doing. And there's no value of information for doing experiments. So we're right. We're managing right. We'll just keep doing it. Yep, good for us. Pat ourselves on the head.
And so they're not going to monitor the effects or consider adapting that program because they have comfortably got in a channel and
No, I don't think that's right. The sediment monitoring programs in the system are long-term USGS monitoring programs, and they'll certainly continue, and there will certainly continue to be research programs through USGS that will be monitoring changes in riparian ecosystems and so on.
And that can provide a foundation for advocating for a shift in...
Eventually, yeah. The one of the worries, though, is that the aquatic ecology monitoring programs, the fish monitoring, the very extensive tagging programs that we do to get abundances of native fishes and their distribution, and the abundance monitoring programs for trout and that, those are expensive. And there's always been complaints about those costs. And I think probably those programs would have been discontinued were it not for the Endangered Species Act saying you got to monitor these things. Right, so they've been more or less legally required to spend a fair amount of money on that stuff. So I fear that some of that monitoring might be dropped. There were hints of problems like that. There was one of the things that we had recommended that got implemented when the mechanical removal program ended, and there was a recognition of a need for some better monitoring of native fish juvenile distributions and survival near the Little Colorado River. Mm-hmm. There was a thing called the NSE, or Nearshore Ecology Program, that set up very high-resolution spatial monitoring for a few years of humpback juvenile and suckers and other native fish abundances below the Little Colorado. And I don't know if that NSE program has been continued. It was certainly one of those we recommended for being a long-term thing, but it was pretty expensive. Mm. I mean, probably talking $60,000-$80,000 a year. Very significant in science monitoring program. Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, I guess my biggest fear would be that there'd be cutbacks in the science and monitoring program that makes it it would make it incapable to judge whether things are working or not. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the sort of the federal authorization of this program and the hardwired funding from hydropower revenues from Glen Canyon Dam is one of the reasons that this program has been so persistent and successful?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. No. Those money would have been redirected in other things longer, but if it weren't for what you're talking about and then like Endangered Species Act pressures to continue some of the aquatic monitoring, definitely. Yeah, definitely. That stable funding mattered. Mm. So I don't know who you praise for that, or who's the architect? Whether it's Dave Garrett, I don't understand. I had that early history of the program explained to me by Dave Garrett and Barry Gold and so on, but it went in one ear and out the other.
Well, it'll be in our administrative history report.
That's
for
one
sure.
of the reasons I'm really looking forward to is how did this thing get carved in stone?
One of the things Dave Garrett mentioned was the critical role of Bruce Babbitt as Secretary of Interior, that it really was Babbitt who said, we are going to do this, and empowered people like Dave Garrett and others to put it in place.
And who sold it to Babbitt?
Well, you know, Babbitt was governor of Arizona before that. He understands Arizona issues. His family's from northern Arizona with connections to the Plateau region and Grand Canyon.
There you go.
And so, you know, this is near and dear to his heart, as well as, you know, being Secretary of Interior. He was over Fish and Wildlife Service, which implements the Endangered Species Act. So, you know, there's a bunch of ways that it came at him. And I think he was also a forward thinker. He was very progressive. He was apparently very motivated by the concept of adaptive management, and he said, this is what we ought to do. And we're hoping to interview him next month. We've been working for about a year and a half to try to get him on
Back at that time, Very likely that would be early enough that the concept that he'd have been taught about would be our original.
Yes.
Management as experimentation. Yes. And admission of uncertainty as a starting point for decision making rather than something to be hidden,
yep,
buried in your models.
That's my understanding. Yeah. Third hand, and hopefully we'll get, yeah, it from the horse's mouth in September.
Oh, I'd love to hear what you hear from him.
Yeah, all of these oral histories will be public documents. They'll be available digitally on the web. I will, mm-hmm, send you a link to your oral history probably within a couple of weeks.
Oh, okay.
And all of them will be made available on a website that we're developing, right, educational, publicly accessible website.
I hope my memory
website
wasn't too awfully distorted.
You know,
you get old, you forget. I've got to confess, I had to go look up a lot of names from old,
yeah,
reports. And
I'm glad you did. You were very good at that. I have a problem with remembering names and titles and dates and stuff too. So we'll fact check everything. And it's your voice and your perspective that matters, really.
Okay. So are we basically finished with the?
Yeah, we can wrap this up now, Jen. Do you want to? We'll turn off the recorder and.
Because I'd like to take you down, walk you down.